Welcome to the Soccer Central Podcast.
Good March the 9th to your football fans. James Charminet, once again alongside John Molinaro, our chief football writer at Sportsnet.ca. What a week it has been. So many stories, so many...
Did something happen?
Something happened, yeah. Arsenal lost 5-1.
Yeah, don't remind me. We'll get to that.
We'll talk about that one later in today's show with Laura Armstrong, good friend of the show, of course. But of course, the one that stands out is the Barcelona game, 6-1 over PSG, the greatest comeback in European club history, essentially. Champions League, Europa League, other leagues, I don't know. It was incredible. Now my story is quite tragic, though. So I watched the first 85 minutes. It's 3-1. I figured, well, you know, tie is over. Had to go and get my kid from school. Had no choice. Couldn't leave her in, you know, on the street corner.
Well, you could have.
I could have done. Yeah, I should have done in retrospect. Right. So I go and pick her up. I come back. I'm making her dinner. I check my phone for the score. Assuming it's going to be 3-1, 3-2, 6-1. Like, what happened here? I missed it. I missed the greatest comeback in history, potentially. We'll talk about that. But yes. Yeah, what a game. Let's head now to Spain. A man with an also tragic story, Dermot Corrigan, joins us. Dermot, now, you would usually be at this kind of game, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. Tragic is possibly putting it a bit too far, but sometimes you have to make calls over what you think is going to happen in a game and where you can go to work in that. And I decided it was not really a need to go to the Camp Nou last night, because that 4-0, and with Barca not playing that well recently, that the chances of them coming back were pretty slim. So I thought I could save myself a trip to Catalonia, and yeah, it didn't quite work out that way.
Just incredible drama, and the visuals post-match from the stadium were just something else at the Nou Camp. What's the feeling right now in Spain the morning after? Is there a sense of disbelief? Will it take a while to truly comprehend what happened?
Yeah, it was really unexpected, and especially the way it happened, you know, because when Cavani scores that goal at 3-1, even for the 20 minutes after that, it seemed like it seemed as if it was over, you know, that my prediction, or your prediction as well, you're saying that everybody thought it was over. Even Barca's players seemed to think it was over. You could see Suarez, you know, he got booked for diving, and he was running it a little bit close. He was getting involved in little niggles. We were wondering if he was going to lose his temper. Neymar lost his temper as well. You know, he got booked for a kick in two of the Barca players in one go. Almost he took two of them out. And it just seemed as if Barca had, you know, done a lot in the first half and got the penalty, got to 3-0. But then when Cavani scored, it was over. Then the 5 minutes have just been, it's just gone down as, you know, maybe the most unbelievable ending to a game ever. As you were saying there, it's the first time that a team has ever come from 4-0 back. And comebacks are not really something that's in Barca's history. It's something that here in Madrid that people talk about a lot. You know, the great European nights when they overcame in the 70s and the 80s, they overcame big deficits in European games. Barca didn't really have that type of history in the past, but they do now. And, you know, the way it rolled out last night, the way it happened, you know, nobody's ever going to forget it, even those who just watched it on the TV.
Was this an unlike Barca victory? And by that, I mean, you know, we're so used to watching them play this wonderfully, you know, tiki-taka football and really kind of, you know, overwhelm their opponents. It seems to me this owed as much to just sort of grinding it out more than it did to, you know, kind of style of play. Do I have that right, or am I missing it?
No, I go along with that completely. I think that's really on the ball. When I was doing some work on it last night, you know, Barcelona had 9 shots on target across the whole game. You know, they dominated possession. They had, you know, at times everybody was playing in the PSG half, but they just passed it around in front of PSG. It wasn't like those great Barca performances, maybe under Guardiola, where they knifed through teams, where in the past when you had especially Xavi and Iniesta a few years ago when he was at his peak, they were able to take teams apart, to dismantle teams who came to the Camp Nou to defend. Not always, obviously, you know, there were a couple of occasions when it didn't work out. But that's when we think of Barca, we think of that 5-0 against Madrid, maybe when Mourinho was in charge of Madrid the first year, when they were able to just wipe teams off the pitch with their passing, with their technique, with their angles of passing and their movement. Last night wasn't really like that. You know, the first goal from Paris was a mistake, really, at the back. The second goal was an own goal. The third goal was a penalty. It was more that Barca put so much pressure on, that they pressed PSG so hard, that Barca just fought for everything. They took so many risks. You know, they had put all their players in the PSG half often in the game. You know, there was one point in the first half when Mascherano, who was, you know, one of the 3 centre-backs, was ran down the right wing and tried to cross, and Piqué, who was the other of the centre-backs, was in the opposition the area going to head it, and that was just an open play. That was the type of game that it was. It wasn't the structure, the Cruyffian, Guardiolian type of plan that you pass teams to death. That wasn't what happened last night. It was more just the power, the emotion, the energy that Barca put into it, the individual brilliance from Neymar, as well as some refereeing decisions that went their way, and Paris Saint-Germain, who fell apart a bit as well. That all came together more than it being a splendid passing performance from Barca.
Yeah, and I wonder too, and you kind of mentioned it at the end there, I mean, as great as the comeback was, and full credit to Barcelona for pulling that off, you know, the result does owe, I think, to a certain extent anyway, to, you know, PSG just kind of choking and collapsing. I saw an interesting stat. They completed, or they only made 4 passes in the final 11 minutes of the game, and 3 of them were from kickoff after Barca scored. So, I mean, this owes as much to PSG's failures as it does to Barca's sort of amazing comeback, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Like, it is, it's embarrassing. It's humiliating for Paris Saint-Germain, and we'll see how it works out for Emery and for some of the players who've been there for a couple of years, but who choked, really. You know, guys who we thought that they were coming through as big stars, like Ferrari or Rabiot in midfield, were totally overcome by the Barca pressure. They weren't able to deal with it. You can say, you know, 6 of one, half dozen of the other, is it that Paris Saint-Germain lost their composure because Barca were so in their face, the pressure was so good, or did PSG just lose it? It's a bit of both, but Paris Saint-Germain definitely... Emery's tactics, you know, he decided, or he seemed to decide, that the best plan to do was to try and draw Barca onto him, to sit deep and then look to break. They got the sitting deep part perfectly, but the breaking part just didn't really happen at all, especially in the first half. And after the first leg, everybody was like, oh, Emery's, he's got one over on Luis Enrique here. He's tactically, you know, he's shown what a great tactician he is, and his team were able to follow his instructions to the letter in the first leg in Paris. So last night it was the complete opposite, that the tactical plan didn't work. The players, whatever the tactical plan was, they didn't follow it. And just generally, Paris Saint-Germain definitely played a part in their own downfall. Not to take too much away from Barca, but if PSG play to their potential, then, you know, they just don't get beaten 6-1. That's clear.
Cavani, though, hits the post. He gets denied by De Stegen as well. There's a Di Maria break as well. I mean, they could have had the chances as well, though, you know, despite that. I mean, I agree with what you said there 100%, but there were chances which they didn't capitalize on. But it's one of those cases where you see teams sit deep against Barcelona and you think, well, how can that work? But I don't know what else you do, because if you go at them, they can kill you as well. You mentioned the controversies, the refereeing decisions. Would you consider this a hugely controversial match? I know PSG fans will say, yeah, it was. Suarez dived, you know, maybe a couple of times. But for you, was it? Did the referee take anything from this result?
I don't think that any of the decisions were crazy that you go, I can't believe that he's done that. You know, you could see why. I think the first penalty on Neymar was a penalty that Meunier, as he fell, he made sure that he fell and tripped him up. It wasn't very clever from the full back, but it was a foul. The second one, Marquinhos has his hand on Suarez or around Suarez. It's probably not a foul, but you can see why the referee in the moment, and, you know, with the pressure and everything that's there, it's not a surprise that the penalty is given. What was maybe more annoying maybe for PSG is at the other end, that they could have had a couple of penalties themselves. The handball from Mascherano in the first half, which was pretty clear after about 10 minutes of the game, where he slid across, blocked the ball with his hand, maybe unintentionally, but, you know, they're normally given. And then, I think you mentioned there, when Di Maria was through, Mascherano put him off, and Mascherano himself after the game admitted that, you know, he thought that he had fouled him, that in the moment he took a risk and you know, didn't play the ball, stopped Di Maria getting clean contact on the shot from, you know, 8-10 yards, whatever it was, and he was running straight through. So more than... My opinion would be that more than that the ref was totally out of order to give Barca his penalties, it's just that all of the marginal decisions, they all went Barca's way. And to win 6-1 in a big game like that, then you got to get those type of decisions have to go your way. And last night they did.
There was a story in Marca today, Dermot, about how, you know, the PSG comeback shouldn't mask sort of Barca's decline. And they kind of make the point that while it was a splendid performance, that, you know, the slow deterioration of Barcelona over the years is undeniable. What's your take on that?
Well, they're not the team that they were under Guardiola. You know, I think Guardiola obviously was huge, but even Xavi Hernandez, he was there for a couple of years more, and he was there when they won the Champions League in 2015. Even when he wasn't a starter in the team, he was still around, and the team still had a huge influence on on what went on. They don't play the same way. You know, nobody really can play the same way as that team did. It's a unique kind of coming together of factors at the time. They don't play too badly. You know, like, it's only last season that they went to the Bernabeu and hammered Benitez as Real Madrid got rid of Benitez. You know, they're capable of big one-off games. They're capable of beating anybody on the day. They're also capable of it not going for them. You know, they went out of the Champions League last year to Atletico. The first leg, you know, was definitely a bad performance from Barca. You've got guys like Busquets who have been around so long. Messi as well. He's played over 700 games. He's not, you know, that old. He's 30 in June, I think. But there's a lot of minutes in those legs. But then you saw Neymar coming through as maybe the start of the next part of the team. That's something that I think, you know, especially we see how the rest of this season goes. But with a new manager coming in the summer, and with Neymar the way that he came to the fore last night as the real leader, the guy who grabbed the ball, took the free kick, grabbed the ball again, took the penalty, and then set up the third goal as well, that maybe in a couple of years we look at we're in the next great Barca team, and Neymar's the guy who's the leader.
We're talking to Dermot Corrigan about all things Barcelona, and you mentioned Neymar's name there. He was just sensational yesterday. The gap's becoming less and less, isn't it, between Neymar and the Messi-Ronaldo grip on world football. I mean, how close is he to being considered amongst the top three players in the world?
I think on current form, then he is number three. Well, we can talk about Ronaldo maybe another day. It's hard for anybody at Barca to overtake Messi, and not that Messi, you know, he didn't have a great game last night by his standards, but in La Liga recently, it's been Messi who's been dragging Barca along. He scored the winner at the Calderon when I was there a couple of weeks ago. You know, when Barca looked, after the PSG, after the 4-0 defeat, it looked like they were in trouble in La Liga as well, and he scored a really key goal to win at the Calderon. He scored, I think it's in 8 goals in the last 6 La Liga games. Neymar doesn't get as many goals. He's got a lot of assists, but that's because he's playing in the team with Messi. If Messi wasn't there, maybe Neymar will be even more influential in the team. It's hard to know when the two of them are together in the team, and because of Messi's TV. But there's no denying that Neymar is on the ascendant at the minute. You know, and the responsibility that he showed. People, I'm stealing that from other people talking about it earlier on today, but the sense of just going, I'm going to do this now. You know, maybe in other games, he passes the ball to Messi and it's up to Messi to do something. But last night he was like, okay, nobody else is going to get us out of this mess. I'm going to do it. And that's Ballon d'Or winning type of performance last night. At the moment, again, a lot depends on what happens. You know, we're just going into the quarterfinals now, and there's a big Clásico coming up in a few weeks' time as well at the Bernabeu. But last night did have the feeling of a turning point in maybe a crux moment where the two met maybe, and we'll see how it goes from here.
Dermot, does yesterday's result, does it change anything for Luis Enrique? Not in terms of whether he's going to stay or leave at the end of the season, because he's already said he's leaving, but more in terms of his legacy and how he's thought of. I mean, I get the sense of the season that he's, you know, pretty much being chased out of Barcelona. Does this change any of the public perception of his time with the club?
I think it will. I think it might take a while, but say they had lost 3-1 last night they'd won 3-1 last night but gone out, and the 4-0 was still uppermost in people's minds. That would be the result that's remembered. Even if they go on and win La Liga this season, that would be the result that's remembered from his last season in charge. Now, with the way it went, he'll get some of the credit. He won't get much of the credit because that's the way things are at Barca. But maybe when we look back on it, in a couple of years' time, especially if they do go on and win the Champions League, he'd be remembered as a great Barca manager.
Dermot, thank you so much, mate. Go ahead. We lost you there for a moment.
The thing about it is that he was always going to leave at the end of this season. I know you said there that he's being chased out. I think he was happy enough to leave at this point, that it's come to an end. He doesn't get on so well especially with the journalists at the Camp Nou, around the Camp Nou press room. There's not a good atmosphere when he goes in to speak. He doesn't help because himself is a strong character. He's a difficult enough character to deal with, and you see that in the dressing room as well. So it's a feeling that there's a natural end, no matter what happens this season. The 3 years is enough at the club, and you know he could leave having won 13 or 15 trophies, which is not too bad.
Not bad at all. What a great night it was, though, for football, really. Unless you're a PSG fan. Dermot, thanks, mate. Always enjoy this. And don't, you know, make a silly decision again by missing out on such great classic matches, okay? I know you're going to feel that one for a while. So thanks, mate. Talk to you soon.
Cheers, guys. Talk to you again. Bye.
That is Dermot Corrigan. You can follow Dermot on Twitter at Dermot M. Corrigan.
That's got to hurt, man.
Oh.
To think, you know, he could have easily gone to that game. And
yeah. But he's still living in Spain. So
yeah, we shouldn't feel too bad.
Could be worse, yeah. So it's the biggest comeback in history. Is it the greatest comeback in Champions League history for you? There's been the 2005 final, of course, stands out. 99 final. Of course, the occasion was bigger in those events because it was the final, not the last 16.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's half of one, it's six a dozen of the other. They're all great comebacks. I mean, I'll go really obscure. The one that really kind of stands out for me is when Milan was playing Deportivo La Coruña 1 year in the Champions League. I think it was the quarterfinals. And they won the first, 3-0 at San Siro. And then, everyone thought it was over. And then Depor won the return leg, 4-0 or something like that. So that was a great comeback, too. But they're all great comebacks. How you rank them, I don't know.
Is it new that we have to have a greatest or a biggest or the best? Has it always been that way? Or was there a time where it seems more now than ever before? I think Messi and Ronaldo really started it, really.
Yeah, maybe.
We can't just enjoy and embrace and appreciate something we saw as being something really special. And without debating, was it the best ever?
Well, but even back in the day, when we were kids, I don't know, when maybe it's just me, but when Maradona was in his prime, everyone was saying, oh, well, is he as good as Pele?
That argument, wasn't it? It was Maradona, Pele.
So yeah. I think these arguments have always kind of taken place, and there always will. I mean, I don't think they're necessarily bad, but I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, this is the sort of greatest comeback. This is the official ranking. I mean, that's a little bit much, but I mean, it's all in good fun, I guess.
I wonder what this summer holds for Barcelona. Who's going to come in? Who's going to replace
Luis Enrique? Yeah, that's a good question.
What does it mean for the futures of the Messis and even the Neymars, whose agent is one to play the field, so to speak?
Well, I hear Arsene Wenger might be looking for... wouldn't that be something?
It would be. I can't imagine that happening, though.
Yeah, to go from one pressure job to another.
I mean, we'll get to Wenger shortly with Laura, but I mean, if you're a big club in Europe... Is Wenger a guy you target if he's available at this point?
He's
approaching 70.
Is he that old?
Well, he's in his mid-60s anyway, right? At least. I'm not sure the exact age. But not that you can't be successful at this point in your career. Sure. It's been proven that you can. But I just wonder, I mean, is he a guy you target? I mean, his record since 2005 isn't great considering what club he's been in charge of.
Yeah. I think you certainly have the discussion and you consider it. I know, as you said, in recent years, his track record of success isn't great, but he does have, you know, he has had some success as a manager. And I think he's, you know, generally considered one of the best sort of managers of the last 20 or 30 years. So, I mean, you at least sort of reach out to him and feel him out about it, I think.
I mean, for Wenger, I would love to see him go to Barcelona because that's the team he's always tried to sculpt
emulate,
Arsenal
yeah.
as, and it hasn't happened, obviously.
Right. So it seems like a natural fit.
Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe PSG's more of a natural fit if they get rid of Unai Emery now, which they might do given that result. And obviously, they were after Wenger a couple of years ago.
Yeah, they were.
So if he wants out, if he gets kicked out, there is a job somewhere else for him, obviously.
Yeah.
He is 67.
There you go. Okay.
There you have it. Dortmund beat Benfica 4-0. Another comeback. They were down 1-0. Aubameyang with the hat-trick in that one. Real Madrid beat Napoli 3-1. On Tuesday, of course,
yeah,
without that Ronaldo.
Really could have gone either way because Napoli totally played them off the park and then Ramos scored those two quick goals in succession before that. I mean, Real didn't offer anything.
How many big goals has Ramos scored in his Real Madrid career? Talk about a clutch player.
I think it's about 18 or 20 now.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, I wrote about it and I can't remember the specific number, but it's in that kind of range. I mean, just
he is a guy
clutch.
You want in the trenches when you have to get goals, eh?
Absolutely. Twice in that game. Within 6 minutes.
For a center
incredible.
Back.
Yeah, it's incredible. Just
he must be the up there with the highest scoring center backs of all time, surely.
I'm sure he is.
If not the highest scoring. All right, and of course, the other result, Bayern Munich beat Arsenal.
Oh, right.
5-1.
Forgot about that.
10-2 over both legs, which brings us to our next guest. Well, she is a lifelong Gooner. It's a family thing. Her dad's a lifelong Gooner. She's long-suffering. You know her from being TFC's beat writer for the Toronto Star the last number of years. But recently, she's actually changed gigs. We'll still cover TFC to a certain point, but much to the chagrin of the guy beside me, she's now going to be covering the Toronto Blue Jays. on a daily basis, like an arrow through J-Mo's heart. It's Laura Armstrong, everyone.
No, it's Judas, as I call her.
Hello, Laura.
Hello, how are you?
How about them J's?
I love them J's, you know?
Yeah, they're great.
As much as by the end of the season, I'm going to get John to like the Blue Jays.
Is that going to be your goal?
Yeah.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Maybe not like so much as tolerate.
Yeah,
at least mention.
Maybe like is too much.
Maybe lift the baseball talk ban from the podcast at least.
All right.
Oh, of course.
Let's move on.
Okay.
All right, Laura, listen, well, I hate to start this way, but you know I have to.
You don't hate to start this way.
Okay,
it's a
I don't.
Real problem.
I've got so many friends who are Arsenal fans, and yeah. I revel in their misery. Because when they're winning and my team's losing, they are happy to remind me. What is happening with your club? You lose 5-1, 10-2 over two legs to Bayern Munich. Arsene Wenger, the protests, we saw them. The ownership's come out with a statement this week, essentially saying that they'll make their decision regarding the management in the best interests of their long-term goals and hopes. You've obviously grown up watching Arsene Wenger football. Is it time he left?
Like, this is a very difficult thing for me. I think that maybe it is time he leaves. That being said, I don't really think that the options out there are great. You've seen what happened with Alex Ferguson, and it took a long time for that club to get back on track. And I think that you need to sort of come up with a better alternative before I sign off on the Arsene Wenger out the door thing. And also, like, show the man a little bit of respect on his way out. He has brought Arsenal and Arsenal fans his, like, the best years the club has ever had and may ever see at this.
Right, but in Fergie's case, the club was somewhat on track in that they won a championship and they've won championships. If you look at Wenger's record since 2005, had he been hired then, he wouldn't be coaching the team now. He would have been fired by now. As simple as that. And I agree with the respect, and you must respect the man 100%. But is it not fair to say that he must also respect the club and realize when it's time to step aside? I know it's hard. You know, he's built that club. It is what it is. The new stadium, the club's footballing philosophy, it's Arsene Wenger. He's a legend. We know that. That won't change. I don't think he'll be tarnished, you know, in the long term. But surely he must look at the situation and go, okay, you know, I've been in this game a long time. I understand when it's time for someone to move aside, and now that is the right time for me.
Yeah, and I think that maybe he should have already done that. I think maybe he should have said sort of halfway through the season, you know, I'm this is my last season in charge, and then maybe we wouldn't be seeing sort of like the protests and stuff, because then people would recognize that he's on his way out. They're working to find somebody to replace him, and then they could give him his due, which I think he does deserve. That being said, I think that a lot of the problems are being pinned on Arsene Wenger, and I understand why. He's sort of the constant over the last however many years. But I don't really think that this is – I think that this is the best squad that Arsenal's seen assembled in the last – since 2005, and I really don't understand why they're not producing on the field. I think that there's a little bit too much being directed at the coach, who I do think maybe – isn't the best motivator of this team. And you've seen people say that, you know, there's been fights at training and stuff like that, but why aren't we looking at the players a little bit more? Because they sure aren't really doing anything to help him.
Well, and that's a great point. And I wonder from your perspective, what, you know, you look at it, I mean, there's certainly talent there. I mean, Alexis Sanchez, I would argue a world-class player. So on paper, this is a quality side. What, you know, how do you account for their shortcomings on the field this season?
It just seems like they don't care. That, I mean, as an Arsenal fan, having watched the game, even players who I have huge respect for outside of the likes of Mesut Ozil, who, you know, we've talked about for years, the criticism has been that he doesn't work hard, he's not working hard enough. And I think that, you know, we're seeing that in too many players. Like, that first goal against Liverpool on the weekend, like, I had to turn off the TV. I eventually turned it back on, but I was so mad.
Well, that was your first mistake.
Because they all gave up, you know, and that just seems to be, it doesn't seem like there are is any leadership in that team. And I'm a big fan of Laurent Koscielny. I always have been. But I don't necessarily know if it's coming from sort of the back. And then maybe we're looking at the wrong players. Like, where's Cech in this situation? He's a veteran player. Why isn't he the person who's stepping up and saying, you know, buck up and let's fix this? Maybe we shouldn't be looking at Ozil. Maybe we shouldn't be looking at Sanchez. Maybe there are other players who should be stepping up and should be like the leadership and the core of this team, and they're not doing it. I just think it's complacency amongst pretty much everybody in that squad at this point. And I think that's why you've seen Arsene Wenger change up the lineup recently, because it doesn't seem to be working.
So is that kind of what they need? Just like, you know, more character players, guys who can sort of provide that little bit of grit and character and passion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you've seen Arsenal teams in the past that have excelled. I mean, you're not going to find a Patrick Vieira on the side of the road every day, but it's that kind of player, that kind of passion that Arsenal has sort of relied on that's changed the game. Obviously, he has the finesse players. He has Alexis Sanchez. He has Ozil that, you know, sort of resemble the likes of like a Thierry Henry and Dennis Bergkamp. But in those teams that Arsenal was successful with, you had those grit players. You had Martin Keown. You had Vieira, who really, you know, sort of led the charge. And I don't really see anybody doing that at Arsenal.
But this character leadership narrative has been there for some time now. It seems, yeah, you know, the last number of years, who is leading this team? Yet Wenger's done nothing to address that, you know, yeah, lack of leadership. I thought by getting Xhaka last year made a lot of sense, a player with some steel and a player that's shown some great leadership in his early career. But he can't even get in the team on a regular basis. Now, maybe he's going to be one for the future, but you're right. Regarding Sanchez, he's one guy you know, I don't think we can criticize as not trying. I think perhaps he cares too much sometimes. Mm-hmm. And clearly something has happened between him and Wenger, despite Wenger saying nothing did happen. That's clearly not true. You don't drop him for tactical reasons. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, come on, you put Giroud in there and say we're going direct, but you don't launch any direct balls towards him. He's probably leaving, isn't he, Laura, this summer? And if that's the case, do you have resentment towards him as an Arsenal fan? Do you understand why he'd leave? Because he does give it all in the field, and that's been a great player for Arsenal.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't resent him for leaving. I don't know if that is a popular opinion, but I do think, as you said, James, that he has given pretty much his all to Arsenal. You watch him sort of the classic, unfortunately, the image that I have in my head of Alexis Sanchez this season is sort of like bent over, like rubbing his head in his hands, being like, how have we screwed this up again? And I don't think a player of his quality should be playing on a team that you know, isn't performing. And if it looks like at this point they're not going to finish in the top four, and you can't have a player of Alexis Sanchez's caliber who is not finishing in the top four. If I was Alexis Sanchez, I wouldn't be staying.
So if he's leaving and Ozil might leave, Oxlade-Chamberlain is being linked now with a move as well. Jack Wilshere's on loan at Bournemouth. He could be on his way out as well. So potentially we could be seeing a very different Arsenal next year, perhaps a rebuild. But let me ask you, what do you think will happen? Do you think it'll be Arsene Wenger in charge of that rebuild, or will there be another man in charge next season?
I think that Arsene Wenger is at the point where he recognizes that his time is done. I don't necessarily think that he's going to leave the team. I could see him moving sort of up in the club. He seems to have a very good relationship with Arsenal, but I think that the club is at the point where they always said that they would sort of let Arsene, or it always seemed, at least, maybe they talked about it, where, you know, they would let Wenger decide when his time has come. And I think it's at the point where, to keep the fans coming in a stadium where, like, they spend a lot of money to go see a good team play, and they're not getting that now. So I think that, like, if the club is wise, especially given the fact that they might turn into a transition and another coach could sort of have sort of a new squad to play with, why not give a new coach to try and do that?
Talking to
it,
Laura,
might be painful.
Yeah. We're talking to Laura Armstrong of the Toronto Star here on the Soccer Central podcast. Laura, you were in, just changing gears a bit, you were in Utah for TFC's season opener against Salt Lake, a 0-0 draw. The game marked by a rare Sebastian Giovinco penalty miss. Overall, what did you think? What stood out for you from the Reds, positive and negative?
overall, like, I was bored a little. You know, it was an interesting game because you came in and anything you read about Real Salt Lake and you look at the players that they lost over the course of the offseason, you didn't think that they were going to be quite so good. And then they sort of, Toronto dominated the game. Like, it wasn't, but it's not to say that Salt Lake didn't have some good chances and it easily could have gone the other way. What I sort of think that I've seen over the last couple of games, having watched a little bit of the preseason and then again in Utah, is that this is what TFC is going to run into again and again and again this season. The target on their back is huge now, and they're just going to run into teams that defend and defend and defend and, like, you know, try and work on the counter. And I don't think TFC has quite learned how to break that down just yet. I think that it's hard to say because they will tell you that, you know, everything's not clicking yet just because it was the first real game that they were playing where there was any sort of pace to it. But I mean, I watched them in Tampa when they capitulated against Chicago, and that didn't look great either. So it was definitely a step up from the last time I'd seen them, but I think that they still have a little bit of work to do on how they're going to break down these teams that just come in and park the bus and try and escape with a point.
And to be fair to them, maybe Victor Vasquez can help them with that, because I don't know what you thought, but when he came in against Salt Lake for the final 30 minutes, I thought he looked pretty solid. I mean, he was linking up effectively with Josie and Seba, so... perhaps he's the answer to helping them break down teams more effectively.
Yeah, he looked really good. I think that he was the one really bright light, I think, in that game. And I expect that he will eventually make it into the starting lineup. And I know that, you know, Dravinko and Altidore have not been quiet about the fact that they need a player like this behind them. So I think that now that they've got it, it's up to them to learn how to work with him and how to make use of his skills. And I think that they're both kind of really itching to get him fully ready, which could be on the weekend, according to Vanny, so that they can have more time with him and he can sort of start basically pulling out defenders so that they have a little bit more space.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he sort of fits in once he gets, starting time. Before we let you go, Laura, yesterday, I don't think it escaped your attention that it was International Women's Day. You were on the TFC beat. I know you're with the Jays now, but you're still going to be doing some TFC stuff. But and there's been women who have covered TFC before, both in print and broadcast, but there wasn't sort of really, I can't recall anyway, a dedicated women's beat reporter. I wanted to get your sense of what the experience was like last year for you. And I don't know, how difficult, if at all, was it being sort of like the lone regular women reporter covering the team, and how you were kind of welcomed or not welcomed by your male colleagues?
Well, it's always funny. I think that on International Women's Day, I mean, I'm surrounded by a lot of some in the newsroom here, not so many at TFC, but I'm surrounded by a lot of very smart and hardworking and just sort of witty and fun women that I have huge respect for in sort of the sports landscape in the city. But when I come to International Women's Day, there's always a part of me that wants to thank my male colleagues. And that's sort of, I think that some people sort of roll their eyes at women who do that on International Women's Day. And I sort of get it because it's all about us women, you know, kicking ass, and that's great. But at TFC, I'm generally, you know, the only woman in the room. And sometimes it's just, you know, John, you and Kurt Larson and Neil Davidson, but sometimes it's like 10 or 15 different male reporters, and nobody has ever at TFC treated me any differently. And that, I think, is exactly what a female sports reporter wants. We're going into the Jays clubhouse and being in the clubhouse a lot more than we're in the TFC locker room. Yeah, it's a little bit different, and I always try and, you know, pick a spot on the ceiling so I don't see anything I don't want to see. But I was really, really lucky at TFC, and, you know, I will continue to be lucky to have such supportive male colleagues who, you know, never took my gender, as far as I knew, into consideration. So I'm very lucky. I'm very happy to have such great colleagues. And, that was sort of my thinking yesterday.
Well, you're welcome, Laura. No, you're one of the best. That's the bottom line. Yeah, I think your work speaks for itself. That's Laura Armstrong. Follow Laura on Twitter at Laura Army. Enjoy TFC and definitely enjoy the Jays this weekend. I know you love spring training like JMO does here. And we look forward to having you back on the show and we can talk some more baseball maybe.
Fantastic. I can't wait.
Good luck with that, by the way, getting JMO.
Never going to happen.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, so bad weekend overall, though, wasn't it, for Canadian MLS teams in the opening weekend as far as 2-0 and a
They didn't score amongst the three of them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, to be fair, TFC, I thought they played better than Salt Lake. It was kind of reminding me of the MLS Cup game in that they kind of dictated the pace of the game and they did everything but score. And Vancouver, they had played the previous Thursday in CONCACAF Champions League, so you could kind of see they were a little bit, you know, fatigued. Montreal was just brutal. They were really bad. So, but
it's just been announced, by the way, TFC will play the winner of the 2017 Voyagers Cup for a place to play in the 2018 CONCACAF Champions League.
Yep.
And also in 2018, the winner of League One, Ontario, will also enter the tournament as well.
So that's great.
So that's great news as it expands. Before you know it, we'll have our own little FA Cup.
Yeah.
Six teams will be right next year, I guess.
Yes.
So we're still 740 teams short, but
we're getting there. We're getting there
slowly. This weekend, the FA Cup, speaking of, Borough against Man City, Arsenal, Lincoln. You're going to win that one, right?
I would think. I don't take anything for granted these days.
Spurs, Millwall, and it's Chelsea, Manchester United on Monday. All the games are on Sportsnet World this weekend. By the way, Mings and Ibra, you saw the altercation last week, right?
Brutal.
In Bournemouth United. So Mings got 5 games for his head stamp. Ibra got 3 games for his elbow.
Mm.
Is that fair, or do you think they should have both got the same punishment? Now, Mings was the perpetrator of the first crime, and it was a stamp to the head, which to me, as much as I'm not condoning an elbow to the head at all,
right?
That was brutal. That was, if anything's violent conduct, it's that.
Yeah. I mean, I think they both deserve 5 games, if I'm being perfectly honest, but I can kind of see why they're giving Mings a little bit more.
He also appealed too, I think, didn't he?
Did he? Okay.
I believe so, which is why if you appeal, you can't, and you lose the appeal, you open yourself up to getting more games.
Right. Whereas really? Oh, okay. I didn't know that part.
Accepted the charge straight away.
Ah, smart.
I believe so. I could be wrong there, but I think this happened.
They were both, and I wrote about this, I thought they were both like acts of absolute cowardice. Like, and I'm sure Mings will say, oh, well, I didn't see him and I didn't mean
it.
But
he knew nonsense.
He knew exactly what he was doing. And Ibra knew exactly what he was
doing. Yeah, and again, I'm not condoning Ibra, but I understand Ibra.
Sure.
More because
you
get stamped in the head. You play sport. Anyone's played sport. You get that kind of, you know, assault, and it's an assault.
Yeah.
The mist descends upon you.
Yeah, no doubt.
And you throw an elbow. In fairness, the course of play, going for a ball, but we all know what his intentions were. But
right. It was pretty clear.
It was pretty clear, yeah. Back to the Canadian stuff here quickly. The Gold Cup draw was made this week. Canada in a group with Costa Rica, Honduras, and French Guiana. Your thoughts on that?
Pretty tough.
Pretty tough. Pretty tough.
I don't hold out much hope.
No, French Guiana should be 3 points.
Well, I don't take anything for granted, James.
Will they have a coach by then? That is the
question. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't. I wouldn't be surprised if it's still Michael Finley still in charge.
Yeah. Well, July is when that kicks off.
Yeah.
The Gold Cup, and it's tough, that's for sure. All right, JMO. Anything else you want to get to?
It's going to be a lot of stuff this weekend. I'm actually going to be in Montreal this weekend for the Impact's home opener against Seattle at the Big O. So have regular coverage on Sportsnet, so check that out.
And we are also showing Premier League this weekend, of course. Everton against West Brom is our game on Saturday. Just 3 games this Saturday.
Yes, and then there's one
the
on
FA Cup.
Yeah, 4 games all weekend, right?
Yeah. Right. It's a weird one this time of year with the FA Cup kind of getting in the way.
Right.
But you can catch that on Sportsnet. And as mentioned, Sportsnet World is your home for all your FA Cup matches. Our thanks to Dermot Corrigan, Laura Armstrong, Behind the Glass, Eric Prime, and John Molinaro. Thank you, JMO.
Thanks.
And we spoke more about baseball in today's podcast.
We shall never do that again.
Previous 30 combined.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's true.
For sure.
So we've reached the quota now.
Have we?
Yeah, okay, we reached the quota.
We'll see about that. Laura's working. All right, everyone, hope you enjoyed that. I'm James Sharman. Cheers very much for listening.